This podcast was recorded Thursday, April 4th at 1:08 p.m. Things might have changed by the time you hear this.
You know, like Joe Biden will finally get rid of his free hugs t-shirt.
Yes, he might have to do that. Mm-hmm. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at the shrewd Snollygosters who make the world of Ohio politics rotate. I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Ann Fisher, sitting in for Steve Brown this week. And coming up later in the podcast, at last, Ohio lawmakers figure out a way to get us to pay more for gas.
But first, the way we pick our president, you'd think it would be simple. Candidates campaign, voters vote, the candidate with the most votes wins. Usually it works out that way, but not always. Not in 2016, not in 2000, and a couple of times in the 19th century. The reason? The popular vote does not elect our president. It's the Electoral College. You probably know the basics. Each state has a certain number of electors. The first candidate to 270 wins. In 2016, Hillary Clinton had 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but he had 77 more electoral votes than she did. Trump won. Ironically, months before his election, he told Fox News he preferred the popular vote.
I would rather have a popular election, but it's a totally different campaign. It's as though you're running. Right. If you're a runner, you're practicing for the 100-yard dash as opposed to the 1 mile.
Now there is an effort to change that system. Ohio voters this fall could vote on a plan to require Ohio's electoral votes go to the candidate who wins the national popular vote, even if that candidate does not win the state. About a dozen other states have already done this, and more would need to join in effect to nullify the how the Electoral College operates now.
Earlier, I spoke with OSU law professor and elections guru Ned Foley. He studied the issue and wrote the book Presidential Elections and Majority Rule. Ned, welcome to Snollygoster.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Just to make sure people don't search in the wrong place, if you're looking for the book Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, Ned goes by his formal name, Edward Foley. So there you go. So we'll keep it informal here today, okay, Ned?
Sure.
All right. Let's start at the beginning. How did we end up with this Electoral College?
Well, it was a compromise as part of the Philadelphia Convention that created our Constitution in order to get all the states on board. But also, I think it's important to realize that our Electoral College is not the original one, because they replaced it with a new version after 1800. So when Thomas Jefferson ran for re-election in 1804, it was a new system designed by his supporters to avoid the problems of this really amazing election of 1800 between Jefferson and Adams, which almost derailed the country. So I think it's actually a mistake. If we're trying to understand the original intent of the Electoral College and why we have it, I think the right way to do that is to go back to 1803, when Congress rewrote the Electoral College with a lot of experience, because they had lived through 1800. They had lived through four elections. The original version from Philadelphia, 1787, didn't work. It was a disaster.
What were they trying to accomplish? I know you said it was pushed by Jefferson's supporters, but was there an altruistic goal that they had?
Yes. They both had a self-interested goal. They were the majority party at the time. But they also had a vision of democracy, or what they would have called republican form of government. They wanted majority rule to be the basis for presidential elections. The big difference between the original Electoral College and the 12th Amendment, which is our Electoral College, was that political parties came on the scene and were not going away. In Philadelphia in 1787, they hoped to avoid political parties. They thought they could create a constitution that would avoid political parties. Well, that never happened. And instead, we got intense two-party competition between the Jeffersonians on one side and the so-called Federalist Party, led by John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, on the other. And whereas originally they had hoped that the system would achieve a president who was a consensus choice, like George Washington was the initial vision, you know, somebody that everybody could rally around and who would be above party, they knew after 1800 that was no longer possible. And so there was going to be a fight where half the country would be happy and the other half unhappy. Then, but they thought that at least the slightly larger half should be the happier half, right? If one side has to win and the other side has to lose, let majority rule prevail. So that was their vision. But they also knew that America was the United States of America, meaning a federal system. So their conception of majority rule was a federal conception. So they said the Electoral College should be by majority of the electors. You're not president unless you get a majority of the electoral vote. And what they thought would happen is that those national majorities would be created by accumulating enough state-based majorities. Because in a world of two-party competition, you know, the side with the most votes is a majority winner.
And it was majorities in states, not pluralities, correct?
Exactly.
That's where your disconnect can come in. If a plurality in one state wins, you're not necessarily going to get the popular vote majority.
Exactly. And so what has happened as a result of subsequent events in history, we've deviated from that original vision by introducing, as you just said, this concept of plurality winners at the state level. So you now can get a national majority with these local minority wins, where you're less than 50% of the vote. There are more votes against you than for you, but you still get the whole state.
Yeah.
And that happened in 2016, that happened in 2000, happened in 1992, actually. I mean, I think, you know, if we're honest about what's gone wrong and what's not working, 1992 gives us a minority president from the originalist perspective in the same way that 2000 and 2016 did. So this is not a partisan point. It can affect both parties, we've got a system where we don't automatically get genuine majority winners because of what's happening at the state level.
We're talking with Ned Foley, OSU law professor, elections guru. He's written the book Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, an expert on the Electoral College here on Snelligoster. One of the arguments, Ned, for the Electoral College is it gives smaller states or the states that aren't California, New York, or Texas, more of a voice. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, I think it does. It certainly is not as much a protection of states as the Senate is, for example, where each state gets equal number of senators regardless of population. But the very fact that the Electoral College is a state-by-state system, you vote in states, not in just one whole national pile, and the fact that the Electoral College is structured to give weight to the fact that you have a Senate as well as a House of Representatives. That's how you get each state having its number of electoral votes. There is this extra boost that small states get that's not consistent with pure population. So that's consistent again with the original view that we were a federal system and we weren't one monolithic country, but we were the United States of America. People can have different philosophical views on that point, whether we should elect presidents on this kind of state-by-state basis instead of having just one national vote, or whether we've evolved as a country and should change. But I think that's a fundamental philosophical question about how you think of our country.
Well, let's get to that question. Have we outgrown the Electoral College?
Well, I think reasonable people can have different points of view on that. I do think it is, if you just look at public opinion polling, I think Americans would prefer to get rid of it, and that's been consistent for as long as Gallup has polled on the issue, which is 70 years. Although I will say the latest polls are closer than they used to be. It used to be that 60, sometimes 70, 80% of Americans wanted to get rid of it. Now that's down partly because of polarized reaction to 2016. It used to be bipartisan or nonpartisan majorities of citizens wanted to do away with it. We're now seeing a partisan difference of opinion on that. I think it's worthwhile to think about should we amend the Constitution to have a better system. But I also think as a practical matter, history has proven that it is virtually impossible to make this change, even when majorities want it. Now, that's not great. Our Constitution is difficult to amend. I think the more practical question is, if the system's not working very well, are there things short of a constitutional amendment that are achievable that would make the system better?
And that's kind of where this Ohio proposal would mandate. It would mandate that Ohio's electoral votes be cast for the candidate who won the national vote, even if that candidate did not win Ohio. So in 2016, Ohio's, 18 electoral votes would have gone to Hillary Clinton, even though Donald Trump won by 8 percentage points. Is that an end run around the whole amending the Constitution thing?
It is an end run, I think, and I think it is debatable whether that proposal is constitutional. I think there would be litigation if it ever got adopted, and it's hard to know what the Supreme Court would do, because I think there are arguments both ways on that. I mean, it is a clever idea, because you're technically using the Electoral College system to kind of defeat itself.
You're allowed to do that right now, because other states have different systems than what we have.
Correct. So it is absolutely true that states are entitled to choose their own method of implementing the Electoral College. That's what's gotten us into the trouble of these plurality votes, because the authors of the 12th Amendment couldn't have conceived that states would let you win a state with only minority support. Why would you have somebody that your state didn't want to win actually win? But that's sort of what we evolved. But you're absolutely right. The Constitution explicitly says states can choose their method of appointing electors. So that's the argument for saying that, well, this end run is legitimate because they can do an end run. The counter argument to the end run idea is, well, yeah, you can do whatever you want except destroy the system from within itself. I mean, you can't adopt a system that's designed to subvert the system. So you just have to decide which is the better of those two arguments. I actually think there's a deeper problem with this compact idea, as clever as it is, and it goes to this point of majorities versus mere pluralities, because this proposal would make the winner of the national vote the winner, whether that was a majority or not.
I see. So you can win the national vote, but with 47%, and so then Ohio would have to go with that person, even though they didn't win over 50. Yeah,
exactly. And it could be 47%. It could be 42%. It could be 38%. There is absolutely no cutoff to the proposal as it's been written and as it's been circulated, and that's a serious problem, because if somebody wins 42% of the vote nationwide, that means, if I can do my math right, is that 58% have not voted for that person.
Yeah.
Maybe they really don't want that person, but they split their opposition between multiple candidates. And, you know, to put this in current context, again, I want to make this point in a way that it's not a partisan point. It just happens to surface right now in this particular way. You know, to the extent when Howard Schultz, the Starbucks former CEO, announced he was thinking about, and I guess he's still thinking about, running for president in 2020, there were people on the Democratic side under the current system that, you know, were quite concerned about that, because they saw him as a threat to the Democratic nominee, whoever that would be, because he would get some anti-Trump votes and siphon them from the Democrat. And that's because of our plurality-based system at a state-by-state basis. So people were looking at the current system saying, oh, my goodness, Trump could win the Electoral College again, because Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida would all split three ways, with Trump getting 43%, but the plurality. Well, if you're concerned about that, or if you think that's a problem about plurality-based elections, which I do, that problem exists to the exact same extent, if not more so, with this compact idea.
We really do make it hard on ourselves. That's for sure. Why not just have a runoff? Some states have a runoff. I think Georgia has a runoff election. Other countries have runoffs. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in 2016, but she still was less. She was 48.2%, so she didn't have a majority.
So
why not just have a runoff?
Well, so my proposal would allow for that. If a state wanted to do a runoff, It could. In fact, states used to do runoffs, but in the early 19th century, Massachusetts had runoffs, New Hampshire had runoffs, Georgia for a while had runoffs in its presidential election. So it would be perfectly constitutional for Ohio or any other state to do a runoff and say, if nobody gets our state by 50%, you know, around sometime around Thanksgiving, we're going to need a runoff.
Yeah.
It would also be possible to do what we could call a pre-runoff, if you can understand that. It's sort of like what California and Washington State have now decided to do with their top two system for other elections. So you could have a vote, say, around Labor Day, you know, with all the candidates on the ballot, not just the Democrat and the Republican, but the Libertarian and the Green Party, et cetera, and say, you know, whoever are the top two candidates in that preliminary vote, they'll be the only two on the ballot in November. So that would guarantee that whoever won the state in November would be a majority winner,
yeah,
not a mere plurality winner. So that'd be another way to solve the problem. A third way to solve the problem would be this concept called ranked choice voting, or sometimes called instant runoff voting, that the state of Maine has now adopted for congressional and other elections. So I think we should return to this principle of majority rule and then leave states the choice to figure out how to implement that principle.
What's it going to take to force a change? Is it going to take, now Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by, you know, a couple percentage points over Donald Trump, but she lost by a significant number of electoral votes. Does a candidate have to win the popular vote by, like, say, 5 to 10% and then lose the electoral vote for us to really wake up and possibly change the system?
Yeah, I think the more disconnect there is between the national popular vote and the electoral college, the more pressure there will be changed, no doubt about that. You would have predicted we would have amended the Constitution by now, given the recognized problems. Because, again, if we could get a constitutional amendment, a plausible combination would be one big national vote, but with some sort of runoff.
Yeah.
I mean, most countries around the world have some version of that system. So, you know, how long are we going to have to wait as a country? Your guess is as good as mine.
Ned Foley, OSU Law Professor, also author of the book Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, helping us understand the very complicated way we elect our President of the United States. Thanks very much for joining us, Ned.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. So, Ann, a lot to digest there, but Ned Foley's solution is simple. If you want to win a state's electoral votes, you have to get 50% plus one of that state's votes. What do you think? Is the Electoral College here to stay?
You know, the problem is you have to get a lot of people to agree to make a change. Amending the Constitution is very, very difficult. They haven't done it in a long time. So I would say, all things being equal, yes, it's here to stay. But not all states apply it the same way anyways as it is. So it's going to be interesting to see how this movement takes shape.
It's really, it's our whole election system. Go right down to the county level. Every county does it differently. Every state does
right.
it differently. It's just so odd.
You know, but we grew up thinking that it was so obvious and so clear cut. And many of us have found out since 2000, it's anything but.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a handful of elections that it hasn't gone exactly how we thought it should go. And I guess it's the way it works. And until there's an outrage, it's not going to change.
After 3 months of horse trading and a touch of hyperbole, Ohio's tax-averse Republican lawmakers have settled on a tax increase.
It's amazing to think of it. The biggest legislative achievement so far of the new governor and the new speaker is to raise taxes. Of course, we're talking about the gasoline tax, which will increase by 10.5 cents per gallon in July. Diesel fuel gets a 19 cents per gallon increase.
Governor DeWine, who originally proposed an 18 cents a gallon increase or lives would be lost, settled for basically half that.
So I was trying to get a fix for 10 years. Look, that may have been overly ambitious to try to do that. We've got a fix for a few years.
A fix for a few years, Ann. Mm.
Yeah, he sounds actually very downcast about this. I think he was thinking of a legacy of some sort that would, extend beyond maybe a two-term situation. But it's done by Republicans, and that's kind of amazing in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, they are just so averse to raising taxes. And even some Democrats are critical of this. Former congressional candidate Danny O'Connor labeled the governor tax hike Mike and said the increase unfairly targets working Ohioans while the super rich don't pay their fair share of taxes. So,
They are hitting up the hybrids and the electric cars, though, with fees.
Yeah. And many of those right now are Teslas, which are...
They're fancy cars. Yeah, they're not cheap.
Owned by higher income Ohioans. Mm-hmm. I know John Kasich sort of left this for the DeWine administration, the Turnpike bond money. That money ran out, so they couldn't borrow any more against the Turnpike. And if they wanted to fix the roads and not borrow more money, they had to raise the gas tax.
And that spoiled Republicans over the last 8 years, though, too. I mean, he did his party no favors by pushing it off because the Ohio General Assembly is still completely controlled by Republicans. There's still Republicans all the way down the line in executive offices, and now they've got to do some of the dirty work.
Truckers promise the increased cost at the pump will lead to increased costs for consumers. I kind of find that hard to believe. Gas prices and diesel fuel prices fluctuate so much.
Exactly. I think they're going to. I mean, of course they're going to fight it. Yeah. I don't blame them.
And they will
business.
Pass the costs along, but will we see it in our loaf of bread? Or
no, and most of us won't notice it much anyways. It's going to be a matter of $3 or $4 a month.
Yeah, and the gas prices. The gas prices will go up 20 cents just from the. Drive into work and to the drive home.
So exactly.
Even on that day in July when it goes into effect, I'm not sure if folks are going to notice it. They are going to notice, though, Ann. They are going to notice that we don't need the front license plate anymore.
I was surprised that got through.
What is our fascination in this state with a front license plate?
Well, police say it's a public safety issue.
Oh, come on. It's just so. I grew up in Massachusetts. We only have one plate. Mm-hmm. At least I think we had one plate all when I was growing up. And, I didn't see bands of marauders.
But now they can electronically scan license plates, and they're a much more useful tool in crime fighting. And I get that. I mean, I get that they have their beef with it. But, yeah. Other states managed to hold down the fort without it. So I'm kind of interested that they ignored,
the law enforcement
community. Law enforcement community.
They were pretty unified.
Yeah.
But let's face it, it cuts the cost of license plates in half. Mm-hmm. That has to help transportation funding. And
exactly.
And the most important thing is what the auto dealers say is that having that front license plate on your front bumper, you had to drill two holes in your bumper, that really hurt the resale value of your 2002 Honda Accord.
Yeah. If you're going to try to sell it in Kentucky, I guess. But in Ohio, it's just where the next owner is going to slap their license plate.
That's right.
Now it's going to hurt the value because we have all these people driving around with holes in their front bumpers.
Now it's going to increase the sale of those vanity plates. When Massachusetts went to one plate, everyone had their name. My grandfather had Lenny on his front bumper. So that's economic opportunity there. You know, you can have vanity front license plates without paying for the OSU or the without paying for the state of Ohio vanity plates.
Right.
Let's take a short break and we'll come right back.
On All Sides with Ann Fisher, we cover the topics that affect life in Central Ohio, from immigration to the economy to the continuing opioid crisis.
But the reality is if you don't save someone who's overdosed, they have no opportunity to recover.
Hear thoughtful, in-depth conversations about the issues that matter now. Subscribe to the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, it's time for our Snollygoster of the Week. He comes from the hometown of our student producer, Jack Long, a town which finds itself divided over a school levy ballot issue.
You can steal our political signs. You can harass our voters and our supporters, but you cannot stop this Vote No movement. It is time for this school board to get their hands out of our pockets because it's our money, not theirs.
That's John Stafford speaking with WHIO in Dayton. Stafford is a local businessman leading an anti-levy campaign against Bellbrook Sugar Creek Schools. He's running an aggressive campaign. His Vote No signs are all across the city. The campaign's Facebook page is flooded with memes and GIFs poking fun at the Levy supporters. He accuses teachers and bus drivers of stealing his yard signs.
Look, school levies fail all the time, but they usually don't have an organized opposition campaign to fight against the levies, especially one that is as aggressive as this one. The police apparently were called in one instance. There have been complaints to the Board of Elections. Stafford accuses teachers of sending hateful emails to parents. Man, it sounds like there's plenty of snollygosters to go around, but because of that, we're going to name John Stafford our snollygoster of the week.
All hail.
Yes. School levies usually are pretty tame. They lose, but it's usually quiet opposition. You never see folks saying, I'm against the kids
right.
out there.
That, and I think you make the good point. They usually don't have anything to fight against.
Yeah. So good for snollygostering, I guess. Anyway, that'll do it for this week. Remember, send your nominations for Snollygoster of the Week to our special email, snollygoster@wosu.org.
And, of course, spread the word about this podcast. And if you have a moment, leave us a nice review on iTunes, on Facebook, Twitter, bathroom walls. We'll take it wherever you put it. Anywhere. We need the pub. I'm Ann Fisher.
And Ann Fisher, Michigan State fan.
Not just a Michigan State fan, alumna.
That's right.
And we're rooting for them this weekend. Thank you for saying.
So by the time you hear this, they may have won and moved on to the championship game. Anyway, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.